From the Holy Gospel according to St. Luke.
Glory to you, O Lord.
An argument arose among the disciples about which one of them was the greatest. Jesus realized the intention of their hearts. He took a child and placed the child by his side and said to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. For the one who is least among all of you is the one who is the greatest." Then John said in reply, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow in our company." Jesus said to him, "Do not prevent him, for whoever is not against you is for you." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
Today in the readings and in the feast days we celebrate, we ponder that very important reality of Christian ambition. Jesus wants us to be ambitious, but ambitious for the right things. St. Paul, introducing his famous Canticle of Love, says, "Set your hearts on, aspire, be ambitious for the greatest things of all." The problem for us as human beings is not that we're ambitious, period. The problem is that so often we set our hearts and our aspirations on the things that are not worthy of our ambition. And so Jesus, when he comes into the world, doesn't seek to take away our ambition, but to purify it, to give us its proper target, and then to strengthen us to seize that goal with all our mind, heart, soul, and strength. And so this scene in today's gospel takes place right after the transfiguration. And Jesus had chosen Peter, James, and John to hike with him up the top of the exceedingly high mountain. And it seems that the others in the 12 were cackling about it. Jesus reading their hearts, that they were seeking the most exalted places in a putative, earthly, messianic administration, seeing what they were really doing. Jesus wanted to teach them about real ambition. And today, he teaches us five things. First thing is one in which the Lord wants you, particularly sisters, to excel throughout the entire world. He took a child and placed the child by his side and said, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me. Whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. For the one who is least among you is the one who is the greatest." Greatness will be shown in the way that we receive everyone in Jesus' name. And Jesus specifically took a little child. And when we generally today look at a child, so often we can have these romantic things that a child is a sign of innocence. A child is a sign of goodness and hope and love. Fair enough. But that wasn't the reason why Jesus was choosing a child. A child was a taker. A child could give you very little back, including even thanks. Many of the times that children at this age isn't even going to be aware of the people getting up in the middle of the night and feeding them and cleaning them and sacrificing for them. To choose a child is to choose someone who couldn't do a quid pro quo, couldn't give you anything back, and to receive someone who couldn't give you anything back in the name of the Lord was exactly what he was saying we should be ambitious for. To be able to love in a way in which we're loving with total self-giving, no selfishness involved. One of the worst evils of our age, and you know this better than I do, is that rather than receiving children in Christ's name, because of our selfishness, we kill them in our country every 23 seconds alone. That's one of the reasons why your vocation, as humble as it is, united to Christ in his poverty, chastity, obedience, and his desire to give us life to the full, your witness as a sister of life is so important. Why the Sisters of Life aren't just another religious institute. Because you're the institute that our world most needs to be able to see real ambition. That for a woman, for example, who's on the chart for a real career, seeking greatness in this world, she needs to learn that her real greatness will come not from aborting but accepting the child growing within. The parents or grandparents who want the best for their children will help them to aspire to that greater gift. Second thing Jesus says about the ambition that will lead us to greatness comes in the second half of the gospel. John said, "We saw someone exorcising in your name and we tried to stop him because he's not of our company." Just think about that for a second. Demons were being expunged, and John's idea was that Jesus' will would be to stop because he wasn't traveling with the 12 and with Jesus. As if Jesus' will was for that possessed person to remain possessed. But there was also an assumption that if the person weren't with Jesus, then under whose authority was the person casting out demons? And Jesus wanted to recalibrate John's spiritual awareness. He said, "Do not prevent him, for whoever is not against you is for you." That Jesus himself could give his authority over demons to people who are not explicitly with them. That part of greatness, in other words, is to recognize the divine charisms that God himself lavishes even outside of the systems with which he has made us aware. In the Second Vatican Council, one of the beautiful phrases is that the Lord who founded the sacraments is himself not bound by the sacraments. Especially with regard to baptism and the necessity of baptism for salvation, the Church says that we know of only one way to be saved forever. Jesus himself said we need to be baptized. We know of one way, which is why we're going to seek to baptize everybody, receiving it by faith. But the Lord, who himself founded the sacrament of baptism and sent us out, saying, "Baptize all nations," himself isn't bound. He can act in other ways, and that's why we have hope for those who haven't been baptized. That the Lord does will everyone to be saved, and therefore, because he wills it, will provide a path even for those who, because of the laziness of Christians, haven't heard with a compelling beauty the gospel, won't be condemned because of our indolence. For us, in order to become truly great, to aspire for the stars, as Jesus himself has placed a desire within us to seek, we have to realize that the Lord doesn't want us to be the chief dividers, the chief distinguishers, the chief people who are constantly saying, "You're not one of us," but in fact, constantly to try to seek the good This again, we're called to see the semina verbi in others, the seeds of the word, the levels to which people are cooperating with God, rather than just seeing the ways that up until now they haven't been cooperating with the fullness of the Lord's revelation, maybe because they haven't even been aware of it. But to be uniters more than dividers, that's a real path of greatness. And it begins, of course, with daily life, including those of our own household. Third means of greatness God gives us, and the third expression of it, comes in the way that we handle all the great graces that God has given us. We see that in today's first reading from the book of Job. Today begins a week in which we focus on this beautiful allegory of trust in God. We see in this dialogue between God and Satan, the father of lies, assertion that the only reason why people would praise and revere God was because of God's blessings. In good weather, people will thank the Lord. When the storms come, that's when they'll blaspheme. And God was going to show us and the devil how wrong that assertion was in the story of Job. And so, Job loses everything. What a day. He loses first his cattle, and then he loses his sheep. Then he loses his camels. And then his family, all his sons and daughters, were wiped out. What was Job's reaction? The devil predicted that Job would blaspheme God. What are you doing? I've served you all my days, and this is the way you treat me. No. Job tore his cloak, cut off his hair. He was grieving, as we would expect. He cast himself prostrate on the ground and didn't say, "Woe is me." Didn't say, "How could you?" Didn't say, "Lord, you're a hypocrite." "Naked I came forth from my mother's womb," he said. "Naked I will return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the Lord's name." In other words, Job didn't see himself as the owner of anything. He wasn't deriving his personal identity from any of the blessings with which God had blessed him. He saw himself always as the lucky steward of it all. Steward, not owner. And so if the Lord had blessed him with cattle and sheep and camels and took them away, it's the Lord's prerogative. If the Lord had blessed him with an extraordinary family whom he loved so much, and the Lord likewise took those blessings away, it didn't alienate him from God, because the real basis of his life was his relationship as a loving steward of a loving giver. What a path to greatness that is, that we begin to see everything that we have as an extraordinary gift from the Lord that we should never take for granted. And then at some point, the Lord may take our health away. At some point, the Lord may take our friends away. At some point, the Lord might take so many of our material blessings, perhaps, away. But if a relationship was really with the Lord rather than with the Lord's blessings, that's not going to alienate us from the God who gives always. Real path to greatness here. Many of the times what holds us back on that path to greatness is we don't understand the greatness of the Lord in his pruning us of certain of the good things he's given us in order that we might not deify them, but in fact ground our relationship with Him. And we do need to help the whole world to grasp this lesson, especially in a world that doesn't know how to suffer. It's lost any meaning of suffering and death. The church has always turned to the book of Job to learn these great lessons, as St. John Paul II did in Salvifici Dolores in 1984, his most beautiful of all documents. Fourth principle of greatness that we have today is in Saints Cosmas and Damian. What made them great? Their faith led these twins to real love. They had received excellent medical educations, and they could have easily used those educations to make themselves a killing. At a time in which there were so many quack doctors just pretending to serve you in order to get all your money, but they didn't know anything. Cosmas and Damian were excellent doctors. They could have charged a mint, but in fact, they refused to receive anything. The Lord who had blessed them with this gift, they wanted to give as freely as they had received it. So they did, and that was their nickname. The non-mercenaries, they were called in Greek, because it was so shocking. And as people came to them for medical treatment and began to ask the questions why they would do this, why they were so good to treat people for nothing, that would be the opening by which they would be able to evangelize. They were treating not just Christians, they were treating everyone. They were treating people, as the saying goes today, not because they were Christian, the patients were Christians, but because the doctors were Christians. And what a beautiful example that is for us, that we're not doing things to be compensated, even by the praise and the thanks of people on earth, that much of what we do, somebody might not even say thanks, but in fact they'll come back with a return phone call and be just as demanding as they were that previous dime, as if they've got a right to our charity. Cosmas and Damian weren't afraid of being taken advantage of by people who, in saving money from paying them, would use it for a whole bunch of other less worthy things than sharing it with others. They just kept loving, and they kept serving, and it was through that continued witness that they were able to evangelize. Like Job, they were not afraid at the end of life, as they were betrayed and killed by the Emperor Diocletian, because they were doing it all for God. And that's why we number them among the great even to this day. And the final witness we have is Giovanni Battista Montini, Blessed Paul VI, whose feast day the Church marks today on the 119th anniversary of his birth. What is the great virtue of Paul VI? It was a persevering witness to the truth, even at the cost of extraordinary personal suffering. And this was something that characterized so much of Paul VI's life. When he worked for Pius XII and the Secretary of State, he was more or less both the sostituto, the number two guy at the Secretary of State, and the personal secretary of Pius XII. And he was the one who handled not only all of Pius's correspondence, but some of the most sensitive tasks of Pius XII, like helping to set up the system to save the Jews. That was executed by Montini, and in Mussolini was getting up on his balcony there at Piazza Venezia and attacking Montini for being way too political. Montini was able to take it, because he was doing the right thing, persevering beyond the insults that his reputation were taken at a time of great demagoguery. Eventually, when he was elected Pope, He led the church courageously through the Second Vatican Council to finish it. And after the council, we know what was happening. Literally all hell was breaking loose. The smoke of Satan had entered the church, as he was courageous enough to admit. Everybody had thought of him as a liberal, as a great liberal hope, because when he was in Milan, he was renewing a lot of pastoral structures, doing a lot of ecumenism, caring for the poor, the typical sort of liberal issues that would come about. But he was 100% faithful to the Lord's teaching, 100% faithful to the Lord's command to love. And when everything was happening afterward, he perseveringly held to the truth, even though he was personally not an extraordinarily vigorous man. Not the type of person you would have immediately seen as a drill sergeant leading people into battle. But even though all the opinions were saying, the present world wants you to say contraception's just fine. And even though this commission set up by John the 23rd had many experts say, who cares what the tradition of the church is? This is the modern zeitgeist. Paul VI had great personal suffering, held to the truth, and he suffered for it. So many of the bishops, so many of the theologians, so many of the families around the world made it very personal against Paul VI. Later, Paul VI likewise suffered with so much opposition to the liturgical reforms that he had been doing. He hadn't entrusted them to a person who, frankly, would have done the best job. There was a little bit of recovation that took place. We have to be honest enough to admit it. But Paul VI knew that there needed to be reform, that our liturgy needed to flow much more into our life, that it needed to be more catechetical. He didn't want any of the reverence lost. He didn't want any of the treasures lost. And he suffered tremendously as a result of that. And even until the end of his life, as he was presiding over things that were unraveling in so many places, bishops, whole bishops' conferences dissenting from the teaching of the church. Very ill, he nevertheless maintained firmly his adhesion to the truth. And this is an extraordinary path to greatness. Not everything's going to go well. We may go through prolonged periods of suffering. Even in what would be one of the most exalted offices on earth, that might be a pedestal of a lot of pain. But he remained faithful to the Lord throughout it all. The church is recognized as heroic, persevering faith and charity. And it's lifted it up as a model for us all. Today, as we come forward, Jesus wants to press the reset button on our aspirations. He wants to help us to seek greatness, and he wants to teach us that road. Today, let us receive from him the graces that we need to be able to receive everyone as we would be receiving him, to recognize the gifts in everyone, even if they're not fully united with us in every external way, to be able to give without counting the cost, to be able to recognize that we are the steward of all God's gifts, but to ground ourselves always in the Lord, even if he takes those gifts away, and to persevere even through the sufferings caused by the good. These are the lessons he gives us today, and to strengthen us, he now enfleshes that path and says, consume me. Praise be Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.